is so exciting. Wow, where to begin?
It's the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
The Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
The only podcast for the Neverwinter Nights game series, bringing you news, interviews, reviews, and more for the community, by the community. You can find us online at NeverwinterNightsPodcast.com. And now, on to the show.
Hey, this is Fry from the Realms of Trinity and the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
Hi, this is Aaron from Realms of Trinity and the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
Hey, this is Kama, a.k.a. Kama, from over at Realms of Trinity.
And this is the 134th episode of the only Neverwinter Nights community podcast, the podcast all about the Neverwinter Nights series of role-playing games. Now, we got a lot of stuff that we've found though, since our last episode of the Neverwinter Nights podcast. We got some news we're going to go over tonight, and we're also going to get into one of our new segments about the Neverwinter Nights 2 tool set. Eventually, we're going to do some Neverwinter Nights 1 toolset explanations and how-tos as well, but it seems from looking at all of the documentation out there, there's some room yet and some gaps that need to be filled in Neverwinter 2 development to get people started. I see a lot of need in there for that to get people developing and actually helping add more content to the Neverwinter Nights 2 community. And tonight, we're going to get into our first segment of a series of segments to go over those things. But first, we're going to go over some news. I got some cool stuff that I found for Neverwinter Nights 1 and Neverwinter Nights 2, and we're going to get into that. So, hey, Ryan, why don't you get into some of the Neverwinter Nights 1 stuff?
Thanks, Brian. First thing for the Neverwinter Nights 1 world is there's a new persistent world called Evernight by Easy Remake. Evernight is an action and exploration-oriented world with primary focuses on both small party and solo play. This module itself utilizes the original treasure class items as found through the unique treasure coffers around the world. The aim of this persistent world is to offer players a vast world to explore with lots of secret areas, boss encounters, and many dungeon crawls throughout. Currently, the module is in development as it is a new 2011 project.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I mean,
Definitely. The Neverwinter 1 community is still very strong and very much alive.
So, yeah, I've noticed a lot of new Neverwinter Nights 1 servers coming online. This one here, the one from Evernight, by Easy Remake, I noticed it's not quite totally up 24/7 right now, but they said it could come down at any given time for updates and stuff like that, because they're kind of getting it out of beta stage and bringing it into a production stage. But, yeah, the information is going to be posted on our show notes. But I urge everybody that's, you know, checking out new Neverwinter Nights 1 content to check it out. That seems to be a really exciting server. And if you like an action-based server where, you know, good dungeon crawls, good raids and things like that, I'd urge you to check it out because it does look like it was really well done.
And yeah, it definitely sounds like it's worth a look.
And I see there's something interesting here, too, like a dynamic dungeon generation system by Sneaking Pastard, which is a very funny name, as a matter of fact. But
yeah, say that three times fast.
You know, it looked really cool because it's a dynamic dungeon generation system where the dungeons actually fill real-time with objects and things like that. I haven't really got a chance to look into it yet, but I'm not sure if it actually generates tiles and things on the fly like that, but I do know that it does do objects very well. The script does limit test engine with like 1,024 objects, I think. So that's pretty interesting because you can really do a lot with that, being such that we've even done the dynamic mob and scaling system for Realms of Trinity. But you know, you could even probably backwards compatible some of that stuff and, you know, actually put the two together, and you could really come up with a, I guess, like a Diablo style server room. Also, there's a couple new Neverwinter Nights 2 pieces here I want to go over to call people's attention in the community. The first one is something interesting. It's a new Neverwinter Nights 2 plugin for like to help people script different encounters and events and things like that. It's by Karoen Nicholson, and it's called Flip. And Flip is a visual language plugin that makes it easy for people without programming skills to script events. Flip features a simple visual interface in which users create scripts by connecting blocks together. I also have the plugin download information on our news section as well for this podcast episode. But it does, something like that could be really good to help people even understand how to program more or put things together more in the Neverwinter Nights 2 environment.
Let's say, that's perfect, man. Maybe I can actually produce something functional code-wise then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I could actually do something useful.
Well, that's going to be hard, I think, still, but...
Oh, thanks.
What if it's based off of something similar, like the Lilac script generator for Neverwinter 1?
I don't have any experience with that, so it might be. It might be based off of something like that, or with that model in mind.
I'll have to download it and see how long it takes me to break it.
Yeah.
4 seconds.
And another thing in the Neverwinter Nights 2, Kadrin has released his newest PRC updates, version 1.41.1, and a few updates that he had to do some quick hot fixes right after it released. But it's available on the Vault as well, where he fixed close to 50 things with the scripting and stuff and changes, and adds some new classes and features in as well. Links to his website and his content is also available on the show notes. We're going to try to get him on an upcoming episode as well for an interview. He's been producing a lot of new content, and we'll try to corral him into coming on the show and go over what his vision is for the future and what content types he's really targeting his PRC to, and where he sees his PRC movement in the future, because he does spend a ridiculous amount of time working on this project, and it does do a lot to the community to see it out there. Even if people don't use it, to at least see how it's done to add classes, feats, new stuff to the system that originally wasn't there, even spells and things and of that nature. So with that, do we have anything else around for news and whatnot? Anything you want to discuss?
I believe that's about it for news. In terms of discussion, I think we had planned some talk about the tool set.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're going to get into our tool set discussion now, and this is going to be a new segment, as I said before, so check it out. On this segment of the Neverwinter Nights podcast, we're going to be starting on a how-to on the Neverwinter Nights 2 tool set. And we're going to get into some of the very basics about the tool set, where it is, what it is, how to create areas, just some of the basics of creating areas, and just getting around the tool set with its settings and some of the basic stuff, the placeables and terrain and things like that. We're just going to go over getting started in things that are pertinent. There are help guides for the tool set are available on the Vault, and if you hit F1, your F1 key inside the tool set will bring up a document that Obsidian has put together to get you started there too. That information will be valuable as well to go through after this segment and as you progress through the tool set as you start working with it.
And later on down the road, we're going to produce a couple of segments on some of the useful plugins and utilities that we've found that we use on a daily basis with the tool set. So look forward to some reviews coming down the line for some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What we have noticed out there, and it's the reason for this series that we're doing, is the fact that we know that there's a lot of people, that I get a lot of questions all the time on our server to, people asking for help in the tool set and wanting that they want to be able to create content. Whether it's just some prefab areas for something that they want to do or submit, or whether or not they want to make some creatures for events and things. We have DMs that, want to get involved in development more and to be able to contribute more to our world, and other worlds are the same way with their DMs and contributors as well. They like to. I know that we did an interview for Kingdom of Winterhaven several episodes ago where we talked to Zell. And most of their content is brought in by people who are contributing, not necessarily the staff of the server. The more people out there that are able to contribute, understand how the tool set works, and to create stuff, to demystify the tool set, and give good tips and pointers to help you save time and from killing yourself when you lose a half a day's of work because the tool set doesn't do exactly what you think it does. This stuff will be invaluable. We'll try to keep it, very basic and go over what we can. And also, we put some screenshot documentation together To go along with each of our series, the illustrations, so that you can, you know, actually look and see what some of the stuff that we're talking about. That'll also be linked in the show notes as well. But to get started, the first thing is, well, what is the tool set? The tool set's an application that comes free with the Neverwinter Nights 2 game. It's a part of all three games, the game plus its two editions. It allows you to create single-player modules, areas, creatures, items, placeables, all kind of different things like that. The scripting, you know, which we're going to get, that's a whole other segment we're not going to talk about today, but we're going to have another segment about how to script, whether it's conversation scripting and or coding. But the tool set allows you to create this content for other people to enjoy, whether it's incorporated on a persistent world or some other medium. The next thing is, well, where is the tool set? Well, when you do the installation of Neverwinter Nights, it does not create an automatic icon on your desktop for it. You actually have to go to your Start menu. It's Start, Programs, Atari, Neverwinter Nights 2, and underneath there you'll see Neverwinter Nights Tool Set. It looks like a little orange icon with like a little forge hammer on it. You click that, it'll open up. It might take you about 30 seconds to a minute or so to load, because it's a pretty beefy application. You might want to insert a picture of a cow here, but it's a rather beefy application. It takes a little bit to load. I would recommend, you know, before we go any further, yes, for system specifications, for you to, you know, comfortably navigate through the tool set and use it the way it was intended, I would say at least make sure you have a multi-core CPU in your computer, at least two or more cores, around 3 gigahertz if you can help it. And I would have no less than 4 gigabytes of RAM installed into your machine. Those are the number one things. And the last but not least thing would be have a nice fast hard drive, because there's, you know, for saving and for a lot of other things, it'll be imperative that you have good resources to do that. For also, here I'm going to insert a little tip. I would drag from your Start menu that icon to your desktop, so you have a nice quick desktop shortcut for it as well, because especially if you plan to go in and out of it all the time, it'll definitely be a lot easier to do that. Moving on, once the tool set's loaded, you'll see it's a pretty daunting looking piece of software. There's the basic menus that you should be familiar with if you're familiar with Windows programs, file, edit, view, plugins, and help. And underneath that, there's some menu bars, there's like tab bars that have a bunch of different options and things like that. We're not going to look at those right this minute, because we're just going to go over the basics. You'll see on the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a Windows that houses a bunch of different tabs, areas, and properties. And then on the right side of the screen, you'll see another one for blueprints, tiles, and terrain. We'll be getting into some more of these in a little bit. But just to understand that it's just a blank slate. And it starts with the basic Temp 1 module to start with. And what a module is it's a file that houses your work that you're working on. You'll be adding all your areas, all your creature blueprints, all your scripts, all your things to this module. Always recommend, you know, before you start to actually create a new module. And that's what we're going to do here momentarily. First, before we go any further, let's explore the main file menu system. Under the file menu, you'll see the classic new, and it's a flyout menu that has module, area, conversation, script. We'll be doing new module. So if you want to go now new and then go to module, and then it'll create a new module. It'll ask you if you want to save the one that default opens, and you want to say no, there's no need to save that. And then going back to the file menu, there's open directory. You'll be using open for most of the stuff that you work on. Unless it's some huge project or persistent world or something, you'll just be using open file. Save as works just like anything else. This actually saves your module. At that point, you can give your module a name. And it'll just a standard browse menu will come up, and you can name it wherever you want. So you pick something, you know, reasonable so that you can remember what it is that you're working on. It'll save your module as a .mod file. And that direct in the actual Neverwinter Nights 2 modules directory. That's the standard place to save your modules. Don't change that. So keep them all in the same place so that you don't have a problem finding it later. The toolset won't throw up trying to find them later. There's a few other features underneath that we're not going to get into right now. Bake current area, bake all areas. We're going to get into that when Aron and Kama go over area, basic area creation momentarily. And going down a little bit further, we have import export. These are utilities used to hand off pieces of your project to other developers that they can import them into their works, and or you can post your works on the IGN vault or some other medium. Run module is used to actually start your module up once you have a starting area, which we'll get into after we start into area development. Verify module is a utility that just goes through and makes sure that everything's kosher in your module. Compile is what we use for scripting, which we won't get into. And exit, and exit actually exits the application. We're going to skip edit. We're going to go to view. Module properties is the advanced section of the tool set, which just to let you know where its basic settings of your module are. It'll show up in the properties window in the bottom left of your screen. As you could set all kind of stuff in there, from the day and time, hours, and the start, month, and year of the campaign, and a bunch of the scripting stuff, which I would not recommend messing with unless you're very familiar with it. Hack packs. If you've ever noticed on the IGN vault, people publish what they call hack packs. Hack packs are resources of pre-compiled information, such as models, blueprints, sometimes scripting, UI files, and different things. If you would like to incorporate some of those into your module, you would go to the hack packs and then hit the little browse button, and you can actually browse and add the hacks to your module. All hacks that you use, they should be in your hack directory under your Neverwinter Nights 2 directory, and so they're able to be added properly. Going back to the view menu, you have the view journal, which we're not going to get into right now, but this, if you want to set up a journal for your campaign or your module, that's where you would go. Factions, a faction editor, that's how you set up your factions. That's another advanced topic we won't get into today. 2DA file, 2DA viewer, it's another advanced topic on how data is pulled into the tool set for custom content and or classes and all kind of different fun stuff. So it just be right, you just know where it's at. And options at the bottom, we'll skip mode and go to options. Click that and open the options menu up. And what it is there's a lot of key information here in this options page that allows you to, once again, prevent you from killing yourself. The first thing that I'm going to point out is that the general options, there is an auto-save feature. If you leave this on, you might want to take a 34-flight jump off a building, because what it'll do is it'll interrupt you every 5 minutes to save your entire module. And make backup copies of it. So I would not recommend using this feature, because unless your PC is really good, I wouldn't recommend using it. Most times it's more disruptive than anything else. It's always better just to regularly save your project as you go along. There's autosave. It's true or false. If defaults to true, I would turn it to false. You can make backup copies of your mod just by dragging it in the folder menu, you know, to make backup copies. So you don't have to use this. I'll just make a regular backup copy. Or work in directory mode, which we'll talk about later. Directory mode is the utmost in safety when developing, because if your module happened to get corrupt during the save process, the entire module will be fully unusable. And I think Kama can attest to the pains of that.
Yeah.
So getting back to the options here, there's some other things here. There's staging paths and things like that. Don't worry about any of that stuff. There's warnings for baking. Those are things that you can fill out as you go. They're going back to the options, left-hand tree menu. There's graphics. These are some basic stuff. You don't need to mess with those. The thing that you will take a look at is going back to the general tab, is where it says allow plugins. Just to save yourself trouble down the road, change it to say load all plugins. What plugins are DLL files that community people put together that are actually like Windows applications inside the toolset that can be jacked into the toolset that allow you to do all kind of interesting and powerful things that the core toolset does not currently allow or was never put in the toolset. You'll find a whole list and host of plugins on the IGN vault. There's a lot of really good ones to help speed up area design and time, and even some other things which we're going to get into. That'll be a show in itself for plugin usage. Plugin development is a whole other topic, and we won't be talking about that probably anytime soon on the podcast. And that's pretty much it for the tools, for the option. And you can hit an OK and close out of that. Then underneath the plugins, that's where you'll see some of the basic plugins, which we'll cover today, but we'll cover as we cover actually adding plugins to your module and using them. Actually, well, just to go back, plugins aren't actually at the module level, they're at the tool set level. So no matter what module you open, they'll be available for you regardless of where you're at in the tool set. You know, whether you're working on module A or module B, it doesn't matter. It's universal. So with that, Aron, how about you get started on...
Okay, thanks. Well, the first thing for creating new areas that is highly recommended is, even if it's just a napkin sketch, is coming up with some sort of image of what you want your map to look like. That way it just gives you a nice quick reference to look at, and you're not sitting there pounding your head against your desk trying to think, where did I want things, those sort of things. As well as the first thing you probably want to do when you actually start making the map is you'll see a tab that has the name of the area as you described it when you first made the area. And the first thing you'll want to do is select Show. That way you can properly orient things so that if you make multiple maps, your characters don't need to do things like run east to end up on the west side of the next map or go north to get to the city in the south, that sort of thing.
It's my favorite, though.
I'm sure.
Yeah, hey.
But basically, for the beginning, the first thing you want to do, though, after you've come up with your idea of how you want to set up the map, is go to the tool that it's the terrain tool. And if you haven't moved things around, it'll be in the bottom right of your screen. And you click on terrain again, and you can draw how you want your map to look. You can vary the brush sizes. You can vary where it's raised or lower. I'll just start by with raise. Obviously, raise, you know, you can set as you scroll up or down from it. If you first click on the terrain tool, it's going to hop you all the way down to the bottom of it. But if you scroll back up, you'll see brush size, outer size, and pressure. And that lets you choose how big your tool is and how fast it's going to react when you click and drag over an area. Obviously, 100, it's going to shoot up. 0, it's going to move slowly. And lower, as I said, it's the same thing, but you move things down. Noise adds some features, so that way it makes it so it doesn't look clean and neat. It adds some bumpiness. It adds some basically random texture, which allows it to look like it's not a clean, neat area, because obviously in nature you're not going to have mountains next to a perfectly flat, you know, field. So this allows it to look a bit more organic with the way it is.
Yes, another trick you can use then is the when you're working with the terrain is the color tab. It lets you shadow, like fake shadow stuff, make certain areas look a little dirtier. It goes hand in hand with the noise and stuff like that, you know, working the smoothening tool and the noise brush to get a nice natural feeling landscape.
Right, and that's the one thing that you really need to focus on, is you want it to look as natural as possible, because obviously if it looks cartoony or such, I mean, unless you're going for that sort of look, you know, the players are very instantly and very quickly going to sort of get the feeling that, you know, gee, this isn't something that they put a lot of time or effort to. And you'll find as you go through these, I mean, just even making a goofy-looking map takes hours. So definitely want it to look as nice as possible. And these are the sort of things that will help you with that.
Yeah, I would add also, too, that, you know, I would approach area design in a multi-phase process. I would start with terraining out from, as Rowan said, using a sketch, your topology. Is, you know, I would do your terrain first. You know, set up your mountains, your gullies, you know, get exactly the way you want it to be, your paths and stuff, with just a standard grass setting. Or, you know, you could use the texture swapper, which is another utility on the right, to switch to like a dirt, because it's a little bit easier to see your terrain better with like a dirt 4 or a dirt 0-4 texture. You know, that would be the first step, to set up all your terrain. Then, after you set up your terrain, then you want to do your light texturing. So you would get like, if you're trying to, you're going to have to play around, basically. We're not going to be able to cover in an audio broadcast exactly the techniques. You're going to have to learn how to use the textures and how they stack on top of each other. Each square in the area, you're allowed to have up to 6 textures. It's not recommended to go above 3 due to graphics cards constraints and, you know, those types of things. Layer textures on top of other textures with different levels of intensity, so that you can either show more underneath of whatever texture you're going on top of, basically a transparency, and you can add more on top of that even. So you can really make some interesting textures up. I would suggest to make a scratch area where you play around with the texturing and, you know, figure out what looks good and what look you're trying to do. There's a lot of textures that are part of the game that you don't even have to import. They're already there. For our Realms of Trinity, we haven't added any custom textures. It's all was done with standard texturing, and we were able to do some really amazing work with just using the stock textures. So, but you got to learn, spend the time to get the experience before you start building areas and to, get the best possible non-cartoony look.
The next tool, once you, as Brian mentioned too, is, you want to work terrain and texturing together. And something that you can use that really helps with that, just a little helpful tip, is if you go very light on a dark terrain, you can use it to sort of emphasize shadows and make things look steeper or deeper than they really are in the map. And again, as Brian said, you don't want to put, 6, 7, 8 textures on there because you're going to make people's video cards freak out if they have a slightly lower running system. But again, if you use even, a texture that's basically the same thing but slightly darker, if you put that on the side that doesn't face the sun, especially for cliffs and such, it really gives it a sharp look. And again, this is a very high-level review.
One of the tricks I like to use, especially for outdoor terrain when I'm doing big adjoining boards, is that I'll start with an area that's absolutely huge, like a 32 by 32 area, and I map the whole, area out. And then after I'm done, I duplicate it and I split it down and I resize the area to just what I want. And that way, when I, I have continuity from one area to the next.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a future policy statement we're going to go over the wind plugins. There is a good, really good plugin for terrain work. It's called Terracopa from Tanita.
It's absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the best plugins, I believe, out there next to the Tintinator, and it's extremely helpful and useful when you're trying to blend one area to another so that it looks like when you transition, you look like you came from the area you just came from. That kind of stuff we'll talk about later, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind while we're discussing area development basics and how that all pans out and works.
Okay, so the next tool that you'll see under the terrain title is the grass option, and for this, you'll notice that it switched from brush size to a blade size and blade size variation. That allows you to choose, what type of grass and what type of height difference you want for your grass. So obviously, if you're making an area that's farmland, you're going to want them to be fairly, similar. But if you're doing like wilds, you want them to be as different in range as possible. A quick tip on that is just the fact you probably don't want to make your entire area with these grasses, instead of giving it a texture that is a grass, just painting grass, because that basically gives, once again, it's given the beating to those poor people with moderate to 2 years ago's models of video cards. So again, you want to try and take it a little easy on them. These can be extremely useful, these grasses, when you're drawing an area that you just want to put a little, if you use it along the seams, is sort of where you get the best functionality out of it. So if you make it look like, there's sections, for example, back to the farmer example. If you make it look like, there's the farmer's land, and right at the edge of his land, there's going to be a lot of loose grasses and shrubs and such, this is the perfect tool to do that, or to draw cattails, on the side of a waterfront. It makes it so you don't need to go through and select everything. You can just set it and just do some very fine-tuned drawing and make some really nice looking areas with relatively little effort.
Also, something too, when you're laying out your area, when you create the new area, you'll notice there's a white square around, like towards in the center of your area. That white square, everything inside of that square is what's considered walkable. At no time can a player ever walk outside of that square. It's what we call walk mesh. And that's a walk mesh boundary. The 2-square radius, well, actually it's 4 in exterior areas, is a radius around the perimeter of the area that is always off limits to allow the camera to do the appropriate fading out so that, it doesn't look like you're watching a science fiction movie and the screen just ends and there's this black void. It's actually done with the fact that you have that for you. And on top of that, when you design your areas, you want to make sure that you're designing inside of those boundaries to help you, to map out your stuff. Lastly, when it comes to walk meshing, obviously, as you design your area, if you're making peaks too large or things like that, they will be what they consider, they'll be broken and you know the terrain will actually be broken. And if you were to view the walk mesh by clicking the surface mesh in the first band menu at the top of your screen, three over from the grid tab, you'll be able to see that there will be like little breaks in like black instead of green. And when anything inside the green is walkable, and anything inside the black is not walkable. We'll get down at the end of that, at the end of this segment. We're going to get into exactly how to tighten up your walk mesh and whatnot. So that'll be down towards the end of this segment. But I also want you to be familiar with that as you're designing your area, so that you're not designing stuff outside the boundaries and then realizing later that, oh, I can't have my players actually go outside the area, because then that's a potential disaster.
Yes, the occlusion grid is your friend.
Okay, the last main section of the terrain thing is water. Now, this allows you, you can paint it, the ripples let you set the direction, you can set the smoothness. Essentially, the best advice I think any of us can give you for this is basically paint some water and then play with these options and see what looks good, what you like, those sort of things. The one thing to note, though, is you can only set one level for water, so you can't make, like, a high-level pool and then a low-level something else. It's going to be at the same height regardless, unless you sort of trick it.
Actually, I believe water is per tile grid.
That is
you can only have one level per tile.
That's the way I should phrase this. It's one level per tile.
Correct. And settings are that way as well. The settings for the water are also by tile grid. So if you have water flowing a certain way, you can have it bend on the next tile grid if the actual river bends a different direction.
Right.
So water is it's a resource that, you know, it's really convincing, and it's in Neverwinter Nights 2 engines. It looks fantastic. I would look at, you know, once again, just like we were talking about the textures, you want to play around with the coloring, and because water is somewhat transparent, the textures underneath will also enhance the way it looks, and the depth of the ground underneath of that area, it also would, you know, they all lend themselves to the same thing. So I would really recommend, can't go through that on a podcast episode, but you can play around with the settings, because for everything from the water stillness, the water flow direction, the rippling, everything. You can even fake out a fake marble floor if you're doing an interior area by setting it to perfectly smooth and a high refraction and just painting that right at the ground level. You actually can fake it out to make it look like a marble floor. We've done that in several of our cathedral-type areas or mausoleums and different stuff like that. It's a ridiculously awesome effect when used right. So there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with water. But remember, it's always by the one height per square. And interiors work the exact same way. If you're doing an interior area, which we're not getting into in this podcast, but if you're doing an interior area, they also, per grid, it goes by that as well.
Yeah, the one thing I think I'd add to that is just one thing you want to be careful of is how much you mess with the colors. It's not that it creates a problem, but, you know, unless you're going for, gee, the water here is blood red, it's going to look a little bit silly to have water that's deep, deep, dark, dark blue, because everything tends to be a bit more lighter greens and browns with most of the other textures and colors. So just something to be aware of.
Yeah, you can also change the color, water color, to something like an amber brown to make a little like muddy water. I mean, but I would strongly, as Rowan said, you know, stick to earth tones and, you know, natural water colors. So, you know, something I also would suggest would be pay attention to your terrain. Like if you live in an area that has not all flat or something, you know, it's actually got a lot of hills, maybe some small mountains or, you know, very rolling terrains. And even looking at pictures, it really helps to pay attention to terrains in real life, because in the tool set, they work very similar in the way they look and the way you're able to put them together. That's the way that Obsidian had developed the tool set to be able to do exterior areas. It's another reason why exterior areas take, you know, infinitely amount longer to do than interior tile set areas, because you have so much control over how you develop the area. It really is whatever you pretty much feel like doing most of the time, it can be done. Now, I've put areas together that, you know, in the Underdark, they were all exterior areas, but they were made to look like interior areas. But because of its flexibility, I was able to to really convincingly do Underdark boards that really match artwork from the Underdark, you know, productions in D&D manuals and different places like that. So there's a lot you can do. I mean, it's how much time you want to put in. And I'd say one last area design tip is the fact that I would start with not making huge areas. When you size your area, I would stick to anywhere between like a 12x12 or, you know, 8x8 is the very smallest, but, you know, like a 12x12 or 12x16, because what you'll find happening is the larger the area you're working on, unless you're doing some kind of trick-out, fake-out thing, it's going to be a lot more time-consuming to finish convincingly. You can screwball an area together, you know, really fast. It doesn't have a lot of detail. It doesn't look very convincing. But if you make it a little smaller, you'll be a little less likely to burn out and, you know, give up on it. So I would definitely consider making them smaller as you start out using the tool set. And pay attention to the amount of detail, whether it's your terrain work, your texture work, your grass work, water work. Really spend the time to put that stuff in. So, you know, and last but not least, things about area design. There's a few other things in the tool set underneath blueprints. If you go to the right where your terrain options are, there's another tab that says blueprints. And ones you'll use specifically for exterior are trees, and you also use placeables. But we're going to focus on the trees. There's very awesome tree models in this tool set. There's a ton of them that come with the tool set, and they're very realistic looking. They use a technology called Speed Tree. And you can place as many trees as you want on a board, but the problem is once again, the graphics card and the algorithm used to render those trees. So never place more than 5 to maybe 7 different trees on a board. You can copy and paste them. You can change their scale, which is something I'll talk about right now. If you click a blueprint, any blueprint in the module, in the tool set, if you go to its properties, you'll see a section once you place it. So you click it to bring it up and then drop, like left click and drop it on your area. You'll be able to set what they call the scale. There's three dimensions. It's number, comma, number, comma, number. It's X, Y, and Z axis. X is the width, Y is the length, and the Z is the height. And if you can actually change any placeable in the game to whatever size you want it to make it look different and all that stuff. So keep that in mind as you're going through. But never place more than 5 to 7 different tree models on an area at the same time. Trees are a little bit different than regular placeables, work because trees have what they call a seed value. It's a random seed value. It's in the properties under appearance. It's a number, and they're all different. You can change that number to get a different looking tree of the same type. So if you have an oak tree and you want like 3 different oak tree looks, you can change that number to whatever you want to, any integer that you'd like to, a whole number, and it'll change the appearance of the tree. Each time you do this, though, it still counts as a separate tree to the rule that I just mentioned, not having more than 5 to 7 tree types per area. It's because of the speed tree algorithm, it'll destroy somebody's processor and or video card. So be careful that, because if you're looking for performance, not just appearance, you know, I would really recommend you doing that. So trees can be used to fill in your area as well. The last is placeables. Placeables are objects like rocks, stones, anything, fences, stone walls, bone piles, some fallen trees, different, all kind of stuff like that. There's tons of placeables. And I would recommend to go through the list of placeables that are there. There's building props, man-made props, nature props, miscellaneous props, snow props, and overland map. Overland map you won't need to use for area designs. That's specifically for overland maps. The ones you'll be focusing on are building, man-made, and nature. And if you're doing snowboards, obviously, snow props. You'll be able to use these props to fill in your area. Take a look at them. You know, spend time to learn those. Those are the things that I would recommend at this stage if you are just starting the tool set to understand what's available to you. That most of the development you'll find in the Neverwinter Nights tool set is finding out what's available to you, what resources you have available, how can you consume those resources to portray a scene that you're trying to, or you have envisioned, or even if you're using a picture or something real, like if you're using some artwork from a D&D manual. Rowan has spent a lot of time researching Cormyr and doing that right now, and how he's recreating Cormyr. So.
Right, and actually something Brian reminded me of when he was talking about scale that's another good thing to do is pick a placeable that's a human, a dwarf, but a player character size. And before you get too far into setting how big all your trees are going to be and that sort of thing, so it might be a good idea to know how high is the player going to be in comparison to these things, so you don't have these gargantuan trees in an area that, you know, it's just a tree on the side of the road. Well, if that tree's 5,000 feet tall to a character, obviously it's going to have a different look and feel than if it's, you know, about the same height as the character.
Yes, that's and that also reminds me of another tip that I have read in the some of the toolset manuals do is to, you know, actually go to the creature's blueprint and actually drop a NPC into your area to be able to see exactly how high or low your terrain is, because it's kind of hard to notice how the size of scale that you're working on unless you do have a frame of reference. So I would definitely be careful to make sure that you do that, especially when you're in the terrain phase of building your board. And all these things we're discussing about the trees, the placeables, and all these other types of things, this is what I would consider phase three after you get done doing your terrain, doing your texturing and water, and your highlights and things like that. Then this is the point where you start actually filling in your board with actual things, buildings, you know, all kind of stuff. This is where you would do that at. And one last item type, placeable type, that it's not technically a placeable, it's what they call light. Areas in the game right now have what they, if it's an exterior area and you don't mess with any of the settings, they'll have default lighting, day and night sequence. So there's not a whole lot you need to do there, but be noted that when it gets nighttime, there's not a whole lot of natural light on your area and you won't be able to see. Something else that you want to play with is actually the lights, placeable. There's only one blueprint in there, but you can set its intensity, its radius, whether it casts shadows or not, the color that it casts. You can even fake out candlelight by messing with the LERP and the bounce settings of it. It's something that, you know, you're going to have to take a look at it when you're going through these, and once again, seeing what's available to you. And as Aron said before about the water, going through and learning how to use the lights for what they are. So be noted though that if you use too many lights in an area that cast shadows, you also will kill somebody's graphics card. So that's our little disclaimer there as well. So just be careful on how you use lights and where you use them to accentuate or light up paths, or, you know, that make them look somewhat natural. Having a big blaring, blazing lamp in the middle of a forest that has no light source, I don't think that looks natural. So be careful where you put them and how intense that you do put them in. So just be aware that that's also a tool available to you to help accentuate your board and make it look more natural. So in closing, is there anything else, Rowan and Colin, that you could think of that you'd like to share about basic area design?
The only other thing I would say is once you think you're all set, probably the smartest thing you can do is to save it as a module and actually run as a character. And that way you get to see it from that level. You get to see it from the way that things make sense, the way that things work easy, and the way that your players or you yourself, if you're making it for your own enjoyment, how you're going to see it. And that way you can make sure that you get rid of the worst of any glitches or areas that don't look quite right before you officially publish it.
And you always have to, every time you change texturing or terrain on the area, you always have to bake the area, which is file, bake, current area. Anything else, including if you put placeables in, if you want the walk mesh to be updated and the area to be walkable, you always have to bake it, because every time you change something that alters the walk mesh, whether it's a placeable terrain, or if you want to see your texture changes, because texture change doesn't update the actual walk mesh, but it will not show until you actually bake the area. So on top of that, make sure you bake the area every time you make a terrain texture placeable change to your all. And then last but not least, all placeables that you place actually break the walk mesh where they're at. So you can't walk through a rock, or you can't walk through a tree, you can't walk through and stuff like that. So be careful that, you know, when you're dropping those, you're actually punching holes in the walk mesh when you bake it. You can set them to environmental objects by like right click and set, you know, convert to environment. Okay, and also to move around in the tool set, to zoom in and out, you can just use your mouse scroller just to roll up to zoom in and roll backwards to zoom out. If you want to move around in the area, like actually move around where you're at on the map, you have to hold the control key down and then left click somewhere on the map and then drag your mouse left, right, up, or down to move exactly where you're at in the map. If you want to change the pitch at your camera angle, you have to hold the control key down, your right mouse button, and then go and scroll, and actually move your mouse up to scroll to horizon out your camera, and backwards to pitch it back up, like as if you're over top of it. So, in the same way with left and right, you can actually mess around with your, you know, take your camera left and right by doing the same thing by holding, once again, holding your control key down, right mouse button, and then drag your mouse around to switch your camera angle. Those are very, they're very awkward at first to get used to. I will be the first to admit that. There are some ways that you can change those controls. Everybody, you know, that's part of the tools option that we were talking about. But I would say that if you can get used to the standard controls, it's probably better. I mean, I have, and, you know, it's like second nature right now. So the way that I move around a tool set's like breathing air at this point in the game for as long as I've been using it. But it did take at least a couple of weeks to get used to. So in our upcoming segments, we're going to be getting into more about the Neverwinter Nights 2 toolset and some more of its features. We discussed in this episode the basic toolset settings, how to start a mod, how to create an area, and some of the basic things. In our next one, we'll get into more in-depth topics. Actually, we're going to continue on in the area creation with interior areas. Be looking for that episode coming up in a few weeks. Next week, we're going to have a Neverwinter Nights 1 Hall of Fame individuals on the podcast, and we're going to do another interview. So,
if you could think of a topic that you would like to have discussed for the Neverwinter Nights podcast, please drop us a line on our forum at www.nwnpodcast.com/forum. And until next time, get in game and level up.
You can always reach us via our website at NeverWinterNightsPodcast.com or by email at show@NeverWinterNightsPodcast.com. The opinions and viewpoints expressed on the Neverwinter Nights podcast are not necessarily those of its sponsors or those of Obsidian, BioWare, Atari, their partners, or employees.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast is a production of the Realms of Trinity, who are solely responsible for its contents.
For now, I say we crack some of those kegs and drown the flagon in wine.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast is copyright 2011.